Hi, friends. Welcome to the By Faith Podcast. I'm your host, Christine Hoover, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week this season, I'm talking with a guest about a specific experience in their life, letting us step into their shoes so we can learn better how to love our brothers, sisters, family members, and neighbors. This episode is sponsored by The Good Book Company, publishers of If Only by Jenny Pollock. Life doesn't always go the way we hope it will. Whether it's singleness, childlessness, or some other big disappointment, it's hard to be content when life lets us down. Jenny Pollock knows what it's like to feel discontent. She walks readers through the process of taking our eyes off the things we wish we had and instead enjoying the character of the God we do have. Pick up a copy of If Only at thegoodbook.com or wherever good books are sold. Support for By Faith is provided by B&H Publishers, publisher of What Are You Going to Do With Your Life? By J.D. Greer. All of us want our lives to matter, to mean something. But no matter what age or stage of life we're in, we're faced with the difficult question, what are you going to do with your life? In this book, pastor and author J.D. Greer considers Jesus's radical call to give our life away to the greatest cause of all. To view life from the perspective of eternity, and to start making decisions now that you'll be glad you made then. If you have a young adult in your life that is about to graduate or is facing a decision about the direction their life is headed, grab this book for them. But it's also a great reminder for all of us to consider what God may be calling us to do with our lives. Today, my guest on By Faith is Sheridan Voisey. Sheridan shares about how his life did not go according to plan. He and his wife tried for many years to have a baby and eventually discovered that that would not be possible for them. Sheridan shares about infertility, failed treatments, and even a failed adoption. And he talks about infertility from a husband's perspective, and he shares how he's learned to recycle broken dreams into service, which he'll explain in our conversation today. He shares how we can support those around us who are experiencing infertility, and I personally think this is such a needed conversation. So let's get to it. Friends, here is my conversation with Sheridan Voisey. Sheridan, welcome to By Faith. I'm so glad to meet you.
Yeah, you too, Christine. Thanks for the time.
And as soon as you start talking, everyone knows, oh, we have a different accent going on. Where are you living? What are you doing?
It's actually the short answer to the long answer really is the fact that I was born in Australia, but I was born to British parents.
Okay.
So I always had a softened Australian accent. And then for the last 9 years I've lived here in the United Kingdom. So I'm speaking to you from Oxford in the United Kingdom.
And what are you doing in Oxford?
Well, there is the kind of introduction to one of the books I've written. So long story short, we really came to Oxford for my wife, Maren, to take up an opportunity at Oxford University. So it was a wonderful job for her to get. And it came at the opportune time for her needing a Proverbs 13:12 moment. You know, hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a dream fulfilled is the tree of life. So it was a dream fulfilled for her. And so that's really why we came back in 2011 now. So my accent is a little bit Australian, a little bit British, and something in between.
Yeah. So I was wondering if people in the UK hear you and think, wait a second, you're not from around here. Or do they pick up on the Australian?
Here's the great injustice of this, Christine. Is that here I am. I'm born in Australia to English parents. So I get beaten up at school for being a pommy, right? Because I had, you know, this somewhat plummy accent at the time.
I don't know what a pommy is.
A pommy. Oh, so back in the day, prisoner of Mother England. So pommy, prisoner of Mother England.
And
it was a derogatory term that used to be used by Australians to English people and elsewhere. So I got beaten up as a pommy, right? Because I sounded English, even though I was born in Australia.
Yeah.
And then always, 39 years later or something, I move over here to the United Kingdom. I come to England and they hear my accent and they think I'm from South Africa.
South Africa?
That's just not right, is it?
Yeah.
There's great injustice in that. I paid a lot for this accent.
Exactly. Although I do like all of the accents you just mentioned, South African, Australian, and British. They're fun to listen to. So we're going to love hearing. Yeah, we're going to love hearing your voice today, all of my American listeners. So can you tell us what you do?
Oh, for the last 25 years, really, my career really has been based on three things: writing, speaking, and broadcasting. And for many of those years, broadcasting took the greater amount of time, and writing and speaking got the leftovers.
Uh-huh.
And then since we've been in the UK, it's kind of been switched around a little bit. So I now do a lot of radio, but really from the other side of the desk, not as a host anymore, but as a contributor, which is actually really wonderful because you get to talk about your own content. And then speaking at conferences, get to travel to the US quite often when we don't have this thing called COVID-19 around, and writing books that then the speaking comes out of.
What are you contributing to? The BBC? Is that right?
I do, yeah. So over here in the United Kingdom, you have some very large national BBC radio networks that really have about 60% of the audience over here. You've got a lot of other, you know, commercial networks as well, but the BBC does a very, very good job of providing very, very good radio. BBC Radio 2 is the largest radio network. It has 14 million listeners per week or something, about 10 million of those in breakfast. And would you believe it? They still have what you'd pretty much call a God spot in the breakfast show. Now, these days it's multi-faith, but I get to be a committed Christian who goes onto that show and gets to kind of give a 3 to 4 minute kind of little message about, you know, the things of God. So that's what I get to do, which is really exciting.
That's really great. Well, you mentioned writing. You've written several books. One is called Resurrection Year, and the other one is called The Making of Us. And you really center a lot of your writing, at least those two books, around your story and your life not going according to plan, basically. So that's what I wanted to invite you on to talk about today, because I know a lot of people are listening here. Their life has not gone according to plan. Probably everybody in some ways. So I'd love for you to tell us in what ways what was the plan that you set out in life to achieve, and how did that go astray?
There's two parts to the answer, and they relate to the two books that we're talking about. So Resurrection Year really tells the first part of the story, which relates to your first question about why we came to the UK. Mm-hmm. So back in the year 2000, I think it was, Merrin and I made the decision that many couples do after they've been married for a few years. We have that little conversation and we decided it was time to start a family. And like any couple who makes that decision, every 28 days thereafter, you are looking for signs of success.
Right.
And for the first 28 days, you kind of think, oh, it's not going to happen this quickly. And so your expectation is met with disappointment. But it's not so bad, because that doesn't happen for a lot of people. And so the second month, you know, you've got expectation and it's met with disappointment. But that's kind of common. In the third month, that can happen too. Anyway, 9 months of the expectation being met with disappointment, we went and got some tests done. And those tests revealed that there was a problem on my side, and that without either some sort of divine miracle or technological assistance, our dreamt of child would be very difficult to have. We didn't know then, Christine, that that would be the beginning of a 10-year journey for us of trying to start a family. And you name it, we tried it to the degree that we felt comfortable doing it. So we tried IVF for the first time in 2006. We tried special diets. We tried chiropractic, which to this day, I do not know why we tried chiropractic. Somebody said that would work. You try anything. We invested nearly 3 years in the adoption process, but the phone call never came to come and pick up our little boy, little girl. We then went and did, at the end of that journey, we did as many rounds as it took. That was the plan. Do as many IVF rounds as it would take to get our child. And so this is by the end now, the end of 2010. Would you believe we had one embryo left to transfer, and we'd already decided, now we've given this 10 years. If this doesn't work, we're going to move on as a childless couple. And we got a phone call from the IVF clinic giving us the news we had pretty much given up hearing. They said that we were pregnant. And so there was jubilation amongst our family and friends. And then Christmas Eve, a couple of weeks later, we got a phone call saying, we're so sorry, you're not pregnant. And so with that, the whole dream came crashing down, and we kind of limped back home and licked our wounds and had to start kind of thinking about what our life was going to be, because we had decided, well, we're moving on now. We're moving on as a childless couple.
Are you saying that the test, that they had read it wrong, or that it was a false positive, or you lost the child?
No, a little bit of the first two. So the IVF drugs had created a gestational sac, but there was no baby in the sac.
I see.
And so all the signs had been there that this was a viable pregnancy. The hormones were exactly right. Everything was there. The sac was there, but there was no little baby in the sac. And so, yeah, it was a false positive, for want of a more technical term. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that day comes. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So that day comes where you've said this is going to be the last thing we do. It seems like for 10 years of trying all these different things, there's always this hope in front of you that something's going to work. But that day when you decide, okay, we're no longer going to pursue anything, what does that do to you? That seems like a different grief.
It is a different grief, because it's a death you have to bring upon yourself. Mm. Every other death that happens in life is done to us, right? You know, we lose a loved one. It happens either because they get old and by natural circumstances, or some sort of tragic accident or something. Menopause comes into your life and it makes the decision for you. There is normally some other external cause for this. Here's the great challenge with infertility, is that you are living this perpetual loss without there ever being a funeral. And so the grief is never properly processed, and it's never finished, because you're always living in this state of, I can't get what I want, and yet I can't stop. And so we had to bring that dream to an end. We had to hold a little funeral for it, if you like. Mm. And this is the great challenge for long-term infertile couples. Couples that are listening to us now, maybe as a woman's listening, and maybe she hasn't been able to conceive for a couple of years. I'm not suggesting you do this now. But for those who have gone long-term and it's starting to affect your health and it's holding you back from what from what God has for you and all of that, the great difficulty is that you're not going to be able to move on until you've been able to actually draw a line in the sand, step over it and say, right, we're moving into a new season and we're going to let that die. Very difficult thing to do.
Yes, I would imagine. I'm wondering how this affected your marriage. Those 10 years of trying, and you said it was, the doctor said it was from your end that there was the issue. I would imagine that would be a certain kind of feeling for you specifically. How did it affect your marriage?
Yeah, so let me start with the experience as a man. Many men, including many men related to the listeners that we have on this podcast, won't go near this topic for many, many, many reasons. Our Western cultures still almost link, intertwined with masculinity, is this kind of capacity to sire a child. And you're not really a full man until you've been able to do that. Now, that is not a gospel way of looking at masculinity, but it is certainly a cultural one, and it is ingrained in us. So, funnily enough, even for men for whom it's not a male factor in fertility, it might be a female factor, even for them, there can still be a sense of shame, intense shame and embarrassment, let alone for me, it was guilt. Because I, towards the end there in particular, after at the end of that 10-year journey, there were some nights in a row where I'd be holding Meryn sobbing because we had tried everything and it still hadn't worked. It's hard not to feel like you're the reason that she can't have what she desperately wants. So there was great guilt for me. And then in terms of how it affected our marriage, I'm really, really grateful that we had some difficult conversations, but we were united in this. We had already made the decision fairly early on that our marriage was not going to be sacrificed for the sake of getting a family. Mm-hmm. In fact, we had this interview once with a IVF counselor. And she said, well, IVF can be very difficult on a couple and everything. And we thought she was talking about the effects of the drugs, because the drugs really, throw a woman into hyper fertility and then almost kind of bring a pseudo menopause afterwards. They really knock a woman around, the drugs. She said, no, I'm not talking about the drugs. I'm talking about the decision making. There will be times where maybe you're both on different pages. And one wants to keep on going with IVF, the other one wants to stop, and one wants to do this, the other one wants to do that. I'm talking about that. And Meryn said to her, well, Sheridan and I have already decided that our marriage is more important than having a child. And with that, the counselor, who's supposed to remain very objective and distanced and, not share her feelings or anything, she slumped in her chair and she said, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because just yesterday, a couple sat in the chairs in front of you that you're sitting in right now. And the woman said to me in front of her husband, if this doesn't work, if we don't have a child, our marriage is over.
Wow.
So that's the kind of pressure that really can happen for marriages going through it. But I'm grateful that we stuck together. Now, she was absolutely right. So many times we were often on different pages, more than at other times in our lives. We would pray about whether to do adoption. I would think yes, and she would think no. We would then go forward and maybe think about, well, are we going to go local adoption or overseas adoption? She'd come out with overseas, I'd go local. We had these different places in our marriage all the time. And I look back on that and kind of see that there would maybe even was something in that, somehow we just weren't together on this because it wasn't the path we were supposed to take.
I'd love to know, at that time when you decided, okay, we are done trying and this new season in our life, what now? I would imagine there's quite a bit of an identity crisis of that I'm not going to be a father in the biological sense. My wife is not going to be a mother in that sense. So what now?
Very much. Every dream carries with it an identity. So you think that if you want to become an artist, right? Well, that's an identity. If you want to go and become a teacher or an engineer, all those are identities. Every dream carries with it an identity, and therefore every broken dream carries with it a broken identity. Mm-mm. Meryn could not become a mum, and that's really all she'd really thought she'd become. That's what she wanted to do, mm-hmm. She would always have a career because she was going to pursue that as well. But, motherhood was the first thing. And I couldn't become a father. So you've lost that identity. And then when we ended up coming to the United Kingdom so that Meryn could take up that opportunity, the only other thing she'd wanted to do apart from become a mum was to live and work overseas. So when that job came at Oxford University, we saw that as a nice consolation prize for her. So we came over and did that. But that's when I hit a second identity challenge, because everything was going very well for me back in Sydney. I had a national radio show, which itself had been 10 years in the making, a 10-year dream that had come true. I had speaking opportunities. I had book contracts. And when I came to the United Kingdom, publishers said, well, who's Sheridan Voysey? Nobody's going to buy a book from somebody they don't know. So I was turned down there. Back then, for the first 2 or 3 years, the BBC weren't returning my phone calls. So broadcasting was out and nobody was asking me to speak at their events. So not only could I not become a father, but then writer, speaker, and broadcaster, those other identities I've built 20 odd years of my life on, they were gone as well. Mm. And so that led to, who am I? Who am I now? What am I supposed to do with my life? Those two great human questions of identity and purpose. And Christine, I used to think that you'd pretty much be able to find answers to those maybe in your 20s. You find out what your gifts are and your passions are, and you follow the paths that maybe God opens for you, and you kind of then pursue that dream and you pursue that purpose and you take up that identity for the rest of your life. Now I believe we actually have to answer those two questions a number of times during our lives. And they can take us actually into deeper, 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 more godly places actually as a result. But boy, it can be difficult. Mm-hmm. And that's really what the last book, The Making of Us, has been about, is actually how do you discover who you are after an upending moment? It might be infertility. It might be divorce. It might be just life has never gone to plan, the career never happened, or I got the career and I lost it, or something that has meant that you're asking those two questions again. Uh-huh.
So what have you learned? Help us, all of us who are either in it or headed into an identity question. What have you learned?
Okay. Let's talk about the first one, identity. So Western culture tends to define identity in one of two ways. One is our career and the other one is our parental status. Mm-hmm. So you talk to somebody at a party and you talk to a woman and you say, oh, I'm a mum of three and I'm a graphic designer by trade, right? It's normally those two. And maybe to a guy, maybe it's slightly reversed. And so he says, well, I'm an engineer and I'm a father of four. So it's generally those two things. But right now, as we sit here, you are so much more than those two things. I'm so much more than those two things. I'm not just a writer, speaker, broadcaster. I'm also a husband and I'm a son and I'm a brother and I'm an uncle and I'm a neighbor. I'm a friend. Friendship is the great forgotten identity. To be a friend is a high and holy calling. And that's what my next book is going to be about. That's going to be two or three years away. That is like the big thing that we're all missing out on. Friendship is in dire straits in both the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, and other Western countries. Yes. So I want to go and wrestle that. So we are much bigger than what we think we are anyway. But then for the Christian, there is this great God-given identity, the fact that we are children of God. Mm-hmm. Now, I had written about that. I'd preached about it. You know, I'd done all of that, done the articles about it. When I lost these identities, I had to really ask myself, how much has what you've been writing and preaching actually gone down deep into the soul of you? And it hadn't. Mm-hmm. But when you lose those identities, that is the very opportunity you have to really go deep into that one, because that can never be taken away. You are, Ephesians 5:1 says, not just a child of God, you are a dearly loved child of God, dearly loved. Now, Paul didn't have to put those words in. He could have just said, you're a child of God. He says, no, you are a dearly loved child of God. This is a great opportunity to go deep into that identity. And then the second thing, the purpose. We could talk about gifts and talents and all of those things. But here's what I've discovered, is that the very thing that you go through, the very difficulty that you go through, the wilderness experience, the rocky path, is the very thing that God can use to release your best gifts into the world. So it's, here I was all those years doing this radio ministry in various different cities and then finally on this national show. I was very much an apologist, a cultural apologist. I was giving people reasons to believe in God and, you know, trying to connect the longings of the human heart with the Christian faith and all of that kind of stuff. And that was good. We saw some people become Christians and everything. It was all good. When Resurrection Year came out, it opened up a real L-turn of a life change for me. And soon it turned into almost a healing ministry. And I want to be cautious with that phrase, but it seemed as if suddenly God was using Marin and I in ways we had never dreamt of to help people start again when life had gone wrong. Yeah. And some of these were famous people. Most of them, of course, were not. But there were people who invited us into their lives as a result of us going through what we've gone through. That has only grown to the point where even I'll speak at a place and I'll be ready. This experience has happened three times to me now, where somebody walks in off the street and says, I've never been to church. I've never been to this church. I don't even know why I'm here, but I feel like I'm supposed to be here. And everything you've just said tonight is exactly what I need to hear. And they come to faith. It's just like, no, so that's what I would say, is that the horrible experience you've been through can actually be recycled into profound, powerful service to others, which can become a brand new purpose for you.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's something that comes when you know that you're kind of through it, or does it? And not that you ever get through it as if, okay, I'm the grief or the hard part of that is behind me. But for someone listening who's thinking, I know exactly what that story is for me, and I want God to use that. How do you know when it's time, when you're ready to let that story be used?
Oh, great, question, Christine, because you can jump too quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think there needs to be a certain degree of healing that has taken place so that you're not actually sharing the story for your own benefit. There needs to be a time in which you are sharing the story for your benefit, and that is you do that with trusted, close Christian friends. You do that with a counselor. You do that with a pastor. You do that with your journal. That's actually one of the things that I say to people. Please journal your experience because journal honestly. Don't try and sugarcoat it. This is for your eyes only and for God's eyes only. You look back, you're going to find that actually it's a lot of the processing you do will be in that journal. But at that stage, it's not the time to write the book or to go public with your story, because actually what starts to happen, and I've seen it happen, funnily enough, being in radio and getting a lot of self-published books sent my way with people who have kind of given their story, and you kind of go, you know what, this isn't written for the reader. This is written for you. And it really shows you're still working things out and you're still angry. So there needs to be a certain degree of healing. At the same time, I would not want to go too far the other way and say you have to have everything completely and utterly fixed up now before you're then being able to use by God. Absolutely not.
No. Right.
I've got some friends who started a very unique weekend conference for childless couples, childless Christians. They were wrestling with infertility themselves. She thought, I will do this once I've had the children, and then I'll be able to go and tell them all the things I was able to learn. And then she was in church one day, and in the middle of a service, she really felt God say, no, you're going to start this now while you're in the middle of this. Uh-huh. And faithfully they did. And it was a difficult conference for them to run for a few years when, of course, they were both the people who were the participants but also the hosts of it. Uh-huh. But out of that didn't come any great sense of we've got all the answers. No, we're on the journey and we're seeking. So the answer to your question lies somewhere between the two, but the primary thing is that you're not sharing it so that you're getting help back. You're sharing it to a certain degree so that you're able to journey with others and be able to bless them with whatever you've been given to that point in time. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Great. Yes, that's great. So I'd love for you to serve us. I like that term, recycling what has happened into service, to help us understand what it's like to experience infertility and how we can love our brothers and sisters who are experiencing that. So I'll start with first the question, what do you want Christians to know and understand about what it's like to experience infertility?
Okay. So there is a whole bunch of people sitting beside you at church on a Sunday morning when, you know, church happens outside of COVID-19 seasons, who are going through this and they've never told you, and they haven't told very many people at all. When they do tell some Christians, then unfortunately what they sometimes get is very quick pat answers. So they'll maybe get a verse given to them. Well, Hannah was barren, and then the Lord gave her, you know, the desires of her heart. Those verses get pulled out a lot. That, for all of our biblically astute listeners, whenever you see a miracle baby happen in Scripture, it's because somebody very key to the biblical narrative was coming into the scene. So for Hannah, it was Samuel. Samuel's the first, really the first leader of Israel. So when it happens, there's always a key reason for it. It shows us that God can give miracle children, but it's never, ever a promise that he will. And so don't pull that out on your suffering Christian brothers and sisters. The men will almost never talk about it until they've heard another man being able to go public with it. And then he'll pull them aside around the corner where nobody else can see and say, hey, that's what we're going through as well. So there's some shame involved in this. There is always a sense in which nobody else gets it. And so the best way that you can help and serve your friends in this situation is holding back every desire that you have to offer advice. Mm-hmm. Holding back every impulse that you have to talk about this particular remedy that helped this particular friend of the hairdresser's brother's, you know, dog walker's friend down the road. because your friend has already probably heard about those things, looked about them. They've already been doing a heap of research on the internet. the best way you can do it is just to be present, listen, say, I can't imagine how that feels. Can you tell me how it feels? Okay, how would you like us to pray for you at this point in time? It might be that they still are really looking for a miracle from God. Okay, well, let's pray for that. But you follow their lead. That would be the first thing that I would say, is it is such a sensitive area, and it's best to be a caring, listening presence rather than to come in as the social worker or the miracle healer or something like that. Don't try and build up faith in them. Just be a faithful presence for them.
That's very helpful. Very helpful. I'd also like to know, help us, serve us in this way. What are some hidden vulnerabilities that you and your wife have? And by hidden vulnerabilities, I mean something that we might not recognize would be a hard thing. Specifically now that you've decided, okay, we're not going to do anything else. We are going to be childless. What is a hidden vulnerability that you have as a childless Christian couple within the church?
Another good question. I think, so we emphasize, and rightly so, we emphasize families within the church, and often churches are called family churches, which is all great. There's only a handful of churches, I think, that really are living out Jesus' definition of the family, which of course is way beyond bloodline.
Right.
Remember that moment where his, mum and his sisters and his brothers come along and basically say, I think something's going wrong with him. We need to kind of, and he says, well, who are my mothers and brothers and my sisters? He wasn't kind of denigrating them. He was just saying, no, in my kingdom, family is actually connected by faith lines, not just simply bloodlines. There's only a few churches that I know of that really, really live that out. So that is the great challenge, I think. It can be really difficult to go on holidays, for instance. So sometimes maybe you go on holidays and you're not too sure who else you can go on holidays with. Now, two families going on holidays together, well, the children play together and everything like that. Well, okay, so a family with children and a childless couple comes along. As long as they all get along well and that's all fine. But there's, I've been in situations where maybe it's two families with children and then we come along for a holiday and it's, you're kind of the third wheel. You're kind of just on the outer because the parents have to make decisions about what they're going to do during the day based on the children.
Right.
And so you kind of find yourself following along on that all the time and you just always feel out of place.
Hmm.
So that's the great challenge, is that I speak to a lot of childless couples who they just feel out of place. They haven't been able to find their place in a church anyway, or just when they do, even with a good one, that you just have those experiences. Part of that is just the lot that we have as childless couples, and we've got to extend grace to other people. Sometimes Christians will be the best possible people to be with. Other times they're going to be the worst because they say the wrong things. We have to be graceful people towards them when they don't say the right things. Okay, that's just the very nature of Christian grace. But it can certainly be really helpful just to be mindful. And this is the great word empathy, is that we, step into another person's experience via our imagination, which is really what Jesus is talking about when he says, do to others what you would have them do to you. I mean, that is another way of talking about empathy, is you enter their experience in your imagination. What would I like in their situation? And what would you like? You'd just like to be recognized. You'd like, your thoughts and ideas and interests to be taken into account, those kinds of things. So I think that's one of the vulnerabilities. Meryn still doesn't go to baby showers, even though, we're, 9 years on from having made that decision. Now, there's not as many baby showers in our circle now because the kids are, all teenage years. In fact, I've got some friends who are just about to marry two of their kids off in 1 year. So, they've moved on a little bit. Mother's Day, Meryn doesn't go to church on Mother's Day because it can be just a reminder of what we don't have. Walking past a park, seeing a dad playing with his daughter, I would have loved a daughter. So sometimes you find that, you have it brought back to you what you don't have. I guess those are some of the vulnerabilities that come to
mind. Yeah, it's kind of like a wound that's always a little bit open, and you never know when somebody's going to rub up against it, and you remember that it's painful, right?
I use that very analogy. I say the wound is healed, but there's a scar, and sometimes people bump against the scar, and you realize, oh dear, that's right, I've got a scar there.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I can't relate to the infertility, but I can relate to that in other ways. So we are trying to, this season on my podcast, I am trying to help us to step into the shoes of other people and to be empathetic and to understand. And so I'm asking every guest, what is one question that you wish people would ask you about this? And then could you answer it?
Well, here's the interesting thing that comes out of the research is that when it comes to infertility and childlessness, the man is never consulted, ever. And so it's always seen as a woman's issue. And so when you go and have a conversation with the doctor will be talking to the woman the whole time, talking about the options that she has, even if it's male factor. When you go and talk to an IVF counselor, they'll be always talking about the woman. And understandably so, because the woman, you know, has so much of the physical burden when it comes to IVF procedures and other infertile procedures that you have. But that leaves the man out. And again, it kind of reinforces that cultural thing that actually, you know, the children thing is all the woman's stuff. And it's not so much about the guy. Men have been suicidal over being childless, but they've never been asked about their feelings, never been asked about all of that. There are some men who have only ever wanted to be dads, as much as some women who have only ever wanted to be mums. And they're not taken into account. So it would have been lovely during those 10 years for somebody along that path to have actually said, Sheridan, how are you going with this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm not sure what the answer would have been because it would have been different, you know, from month to month. I wasn't one of those guys who just had to have children. I was okay, you know, moving along. But there were times when I could have done with being able to offload and say, you know what, I just feel this is so unfair. And why do other people get the children and we don't? Why do other people get the miracles and we don't? Is it because I don't have enough faith? You know, there were times that I was really ripping myself apart because I thought, well, you know, it must be you, Sheridan. Not just biologically, maybe your faith isn't strong enough. You're not filled with the spirit enough, you know, something like that. Ripping myself apart on top of the grief of the virginity itself. So that's it's one gift of a question that you could ask a guy. Mm-hmm. If you come across some guy who's going through that, is just saying, how are you doing with this journey this week?
Mm-hmm. So I'm imagining that there are people listening who are experiencing this, both men and women, or maybe a woman who then says, hey, to her husband, you need to listen to this. What would you say to them? So all those things you just expressed, I would imagine they are feeling that. What truth and wisdom could you offer them?
At this moment, you're probably thinking that if you don't have children, your life is over. And that's what so many couples feel, because it is a God-given and a biologically driven desire to have children. And so when it doesn't come, there's reason why you're feeling this way. But I would like to give you hope that whatever happens, you're listening to a voice who's been through it, and we've been 10 years now, and we're in a good place. And so we've been able to come to a place of healing. And like we said before, there's still a scar, but you know, we're in a good place. We're not thinking about this every day by any means, not every month, just not thinking about it. We're able to move on and be able to do whatever God's called us to do now. So you will be able to heal if this isn't to be your path. The majority of people who wrestle with infertility, in most cases, something works out. IVF works, adoption works, fostering works. God gives them a miracle. Something happens. There's a very small percentage of us who don't get that. And for those people, I say, you can heal and you can move on. I would also say that there is a lot more resources out there now. There's some really good books. There's some really good communities, online communities. There's some online communities for men, which certainly went around when I was really going through that. And so you can kind of, you know, get involved, in one of these Facebook groups. It's large enough that you can be anonymous for a little while. You can just listen in. But you're amongst a whole bunch of guys who are also going through this. So there's resources out there to support you, but also there is hope at the end of the day too.
Mm-hmm. And your resources are out there to support them. The book Resurrection Year is specifically about the issue of infertility. And you, in the end of that book, you have did you call it a creed?
Yeah, that's at the end of the second book, The Making of Us.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you mind speaking that over us just as a closing kind of blessing to our listeners?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to. So The Making of Us, the storyline is actually about a friend and I doing a pilgrimage through the north of England and asking these big questions about identity and purpose. And so the creed kind of brings the whole of the book together, and all the things that I learned writing the book. Took 5 years to write the book to try and not get any cliches in there and really get some insight. And this kind of really is the summation of the book, if you like. And you can print this off and put on your wall, as many people have done. But it goes like this. The hand that spins the galaxies brought me into being. The one who holds the stars has made me his own. I am God's child. My life is rich. My days are sacred. I am held by a love that's wider and higher than the farthest edges of this expanding universe. I am a pilgrim in this world, in search of wisdom and wonder. I will take new adventures and follow God into the unknown. What I achieve is not as important as the person I become. So I will seek to imitate the nail-pierced one. I will step in the direction of my strengths and talents. They are spirit-given tools for my God-given tasks. I will pay attention to my persistent aspirations. They could be the whispers of God. I will serve all I can and walk deeply with a few. I will aim for great things, but leave my legacy to God. The path is long and the terrain at times hard. Still, I will not wish for another's life. I will take my place, play my part. Something will be missed if I'm not doing that. For the hand that spins the galaxies wants me here.
That's beautiful. Even more beautiful in your accent. I will put that printable in the show notes for anybody who wants to have that in writing. And again, his books are Resurrection Year and The Making of Us. Sheridan, thank you for joining me today. This was such a helpful conversation.
Well, thank you for the time, Christine.
Isn't Sheridan's creed simply beautiful? I have put a link in the show notes to the printable creed so that you can have a copy for yourself. And you're going to also want to check out his books while you're there looking at links and grab a copy or two. Friends, join me next week as I talk with Elizabeth Woodson. I loved getting to meet Elizabeth through this conversation, and you're going to love her. Elizabeth serves on staff at the Village Church in Texas and joins me to share her origin story. I'm fascinated by origin stories, meaning how did someone get where they are? How did God move them and fit pieces of their interests and gifts with open doors of opportunity? Elizabeth shares how God did that in her own life, how God called her into ministry, and how she developed the skill of teaching the Bible. She also shares how her singleness has been both a challenge and an opportunity in her ministry. You're going to love meeting Elizabeth. And until then, friends, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.